The court is now ready to hear argument in 040431, PR Investments and Specialty Retailers, Inc. versus the State of Texas.
May it please the court, Mr. Dixon Montague will present arguments for the petitioner. Each group will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. It is vital that the errors of the Court of Appeals be corrected. We are to have a fair and efficient condemnation process in this state. The Texas Department of Transportation's actions in this case implicate both the substantive and procedural rules of the condemnation laws in this state, the Texas rules of civil procedure, as well as the inherent power of a trial court to rule its court fairly and efficiently and in accordance with the law. The condemnation case that is involved here is what we, in the condemnation practice at least, refer to as a partial takings case. The property that is involved had a multi-story office complex and distribution facility on it that was being leased, and the front part of it was reserved for retail commercial development. The state of Texas took
Mr. Montague, as I understand these facts, there were some negotiations going on which plan was going to be used, and from my reading, it appears that perhaps a tenant wasn't informed of the final plan, and that issue concerns me because as I read this work, it seems to me that that would be, I guess in a sense, some type of trial by ambush, and because they didn't have notice, as I read it, they didn't have notice of this proceeding or the final proceeding.
Justice Medina, there was a tenant involved. The tenant was leasing the multi-story office complex and distribution facility. An agreement was made with the tenant as well as with PRI prior to the special commissioner's hearing in this case that the state would construct its facility in accordance with a specified plan that would provide acceleration and deceleration lanes into the property to provide safe access. And that without it, the tenant told the state, as did PRI, that the tenant would leave the property, and as a result, it would cost PRI in excess of $5 million in damages. The state, looking at the safety concerns that both PRI and specialty retailers had, did its engineering design work and concluded that they were justified in requesting the acceleration and deceleration lanes, changed its plan in order to incorporate those acceleration and deceleration lanes into its plan so that the property could have safe access in and out. As a result of that, Specialty Retailers was induced not to participate in the condemnation process and did not participate at the special commissioner's hearing, with the exception of calling PRI thereafter to confirm that, in fact, the state did represent in that administrative hearing that it was going to construct its project in accordance with the plan that the state represented to Specialty Retailers that it was going to do with acceleration and deceleration lanes. At that hearing, the state swore to that.
This could have all been fixed with a short continuance, couldn't it?
No, sir, it could not.
Why not?
Article 1, Section 17 is at the very heart of this case. Article 1, Section 17 provides that in determining the compensation to which a property owner is entitled, there is a special commissioner's process that is established. And the reason is because the Constitution in Article 1, Section 17 provides that before a condemning authority may take possession of one's property, the property owner must first be paid adequate compensation. The legislature has established the special commissioner's process in order to determine the compensation that shall first be paid. Those special commissioners listen to the evidence of the condemning authority as to what it plans to do with the use of the property. If, in this case, the state comes in and represents that it plans to use the property in a specified way.
Well, why shouldn't we apply a certain level of abstraction to the phrase intended use? I mean, the state intended to use the condemned property to build a controlled access highway, and That was true when the condemnation proceedings were instituted, and it was true at the time of trial. So why didn't they satisfy both Article 1, Section 17, and the condemnation procedures here?
It could have, Your Honor. It certainly could have in connection with the case. It could have come to the special commissioner's hearing and stood simply on its pleadings and stated that we are taking this property for highway purposes, a generic statement. If that were the case, as this Supreme Court has said in the Gleghorn versus City of Wichita Falls case, in Creighton versus State, and in all of those cases that you see Justice McGee citing in City of Pearland versus Alexander, if the state had done that, then the property owner was entitled to put on evidence at that special commissioner's hearing of the fullest extent to which the state could use the property condemned in order to determine the damages at the special commissioner's hearing that the condemnor would be obligated to first pay as a condition for taking that property and using it. However, in this instance, the condemning authority chose not to stand on its generic pleading, giving the property owner the opportunity to come in and put on evidence of the fullest extent to which the state could put the property, but instead chose to limit the use to which it was going to put its property, specifically defining that use to a plan with acceleration and deceleration lanes in order to keep down the amount of compensation to which both specialty retailers and PRI were entitled. So much so that specialty retailers decided not even to participate in the process because it was satisfied.
But it is a trial de novo in the county court.
It is a trial de novo.
With a short continuance, we could have considered all of that. Yes, we would have skipped part. I'm just concerned. We're trying to avoid declaring lots of things jurisdictional. Then people, if it's jurisdictional, then 30 years from now or 100 years from now, there was no jurisdiction. Pay no attention to that judgment. I went to all the problems that has with it. I'm just concerned with your argument that you can't, if you didn't tell the special commissioners it's jurisdictional. I mean, there's a lot of things that might change in how you're going to use the property you're going to take. Is every one of those going to be jurisdictional?
No, Your Honor. With respect, this is not a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. It has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with subject matter jurisdiction. Once the case is appealed from the special commissioner's award to the trial court has subject matter jurisdiction of that cause. It has subject matter jurisdiction of not only the compensation dispute from which there has been an appeal, but also every other issue that there may be in the condemnation process, including good faith negotiations, including other issues dealing with the right to take. It's not a matter of subject matter jurisdiction that's subject to collateral attack, because those types of jurisdictional elements that the trial court can consider may be waived by either the property owner or the condemning authority, depending on what the circumstances are.
Well, I'm confused. Didn't the trial court say that it was divested of jurisdiction by the state's change from the Sparks plan to the Quarter plan?
In the context that it did not have jurisdiction to award the state title to the property that it was claiming, that it didn't have jurisdiction to sign a judgment divesting title from the property owner and vesting it in the condemning authority. That's the context in which the jurisdictional statement.
What kind of jurisdiction is that?
The power to proceed in a condemnation case.
So well, it's jurisdiction of an appellate nature. I mean, is that they were saying that we don't have the necessary prerequisite to be able to render a judgment. It's outside of our appellate function. It would be as though we sent something back for further review in the Court of Appeals that we wasn't resolved yet. That's not a good example, but something goes back to the trial court to resolve before it's ripe to come up for review.
That is right in the context of the compensation equation. And here's what's most important, and this may be very helpful to understand, is getting back to Article 1, Section 17. If there is the obligation for the condemning authority to first pay the property owner just compensation as a condition to occupying and using the property owner's property, and the legislature has established the special commissioner's process in order to do that, and then you have a condemning authority who comes to that process and puts on evidence, specific plans in order to try to keep that compensation down, and then subsequent thereto changes those plans after the special commissioner's process is over, increasing those damages to the property owner by millions of dollars, then that property owner is not adequately compensated for his property initially before possession is taken.
Well, and that was going to be my question. What part does the commissioner's award play in the trial de novo? Can the trial court abate and send it back to the special commissioners in light of the changed circumstances? Can the trial court take the different factors into account and change the commissioner's award? Or is the trial court bound to only affirm the dollar amount or not affirm the dollar amount? Well, what's the trial court's authority vis-a-vis the damage award by the commissioners?
It is a trial de novo on the compensation award made by the special commissioners. However, what this Supreme Court has said in State versus Nelson, as well as a number of other cases, that if the compensation facts are substantially and materially changed from those presented to the special commissioners, then the court does not have authority to vest title in the condemning authority for the property that the condemning authority seeks. And the reason is very simple, and I can use this example in this case. Based on the plan that the condemning authority posited for the use of the property, the damages awarded by the special commissioners were $200,000. However, if the state had pursued the plan that it was now going to pursue at trial, if it had presented that at the special commissioner's proceeding, the property owner would have had in excess of $5 million worth of damages. So here is the property owner without that adequate compensation that the Constitution says shall first be paid as a condition.
Of course, that's always true. That's true in every condemnation case where the county court judgment is higher than the special commissioner's judgment.
But the only distinction is, as this Supreme Court has said, that those compensation facts that are presented at the county court level must be the same compensation facts presented at the special commissioner's hearing.
Right. So your argument is not based on you hadn't paid me enough. You took it without paying me, and you took it paying me a little now and more later. Your argument is just if the facts are different, you can't do it.
That's correct. That's exactly right. If they
my problem is, isn't that going to always be true? Don't people, state governments decide they're going to do toll roads and then not do toll roads and then put it on two-year moratoriums and all this stuff? How are we ever going to decide these cases?
Doesn't the statute provide for a change of plans in these condemnation proceedings?
Well, it's as simple as this, is that if a condemning authority wants to condemn property, then it must go to the special commissioner's hearing with the plans that it intends to put the property to so that the special commissioners can determine the compensation to which the property owner is entitled so that amount can first be paid to the property owner as a condition to possession.
You know, it almost sounds to me like your argument really should be made to the legislature, that the statute, if there is abuse that's occasioned by the sort of bait-and-switch tactics that you allege here, then legislature can conduct hearings and then safeguard property owners if the condemning authority, if it's shown that across the state they're changing their use dramatically from what they presented at the to the special commissioners.
Well, this court has put in that safeguard.
Well, what I'm looking at right now is the statute. The statute says the state has to describe the land, it has to state the purpose, it has to state the property owner's name, and an inability to agree. And it seems to me that they ticked down each one of those elements in presenting this condemnation proceeding. So, where does the statute provide the level of specificity that you're asking for here?
You're looking at 21.012. What you need to be looking at is 21.041 and 21.042. And the reason is that not only are you looking at the particular statute, you're looking at the evidence that's put before the special commissioners in order to determine compensation regarding the use to which the property is put. It's 21.041 and 042 that it's material to this case.
So what, counsel, assuming all the parties are operating in good faith, your clients believe there's an agreement on the plan to be pursued, the Sparks plan, not the Quarter plan, as I understand it, and there are legitimate questions that the state has, perhaps based upon the objections made to the commissioner's findings. So some changes are made, not to the land that's to be condemned, but some of the surrounding effects, like the lane, the signage, the signals, that kind of thing. Then what should have happened in this case? If the state legitimately believes there's heightened safety concerns by the Sparks plan and that there should be changes made,
the state is free to make those changes. The consequence is, if those changes are substantial and material, then the process should go back to the special commissioners, and the special commissioners should decide compensation based on that new plan so that the property owner may be adequately compensated during the condemnation process. For example, here...
So the trial judge's judgment should have said dismissed without prejudice but not based on jurisdiction.
It did say dismissed without prejudice, and with respect to the jurisdiction to which it was speaking, it simply said it did not have authority to vest title in the state for the property that was being acquired. That's what it said here, and it did so rightfully, because if the condemning authority is allowed to put on evidence of one plan that keeps the damages down, for example, at $200,000, and switches that, does a bait and switch after the special commissioner's hearing and causes $5 million in damages, then here's the property owner during the whole judicial process having $5 million worth of damages to his property, but not having the compensation in order to try to react to it during the whole process.
So are you saying the trial court's judgment was accurate as being misconstrued on appeal, that it did not really base the dismissal on jurisdiction?
It was not a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, and the Court of Appeals did err in that regard. It has nothing whatsoever to do with subject matter jurisdiction.
Any other questions?
Now, on rebuttal, I want to ask you about Justice Anderson's opinion, dissent in that.
Well, you may want to ask me now, because it's Mr. Hoagland that has the rebuttal.
Oh, that's okay.
We'll take that up on rebuttal with Mr. Hoagland. The Court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the Court, Ms. Danica Milios will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the Court. This case calls upon the Court to decide whether it really meant what it said in Hubenak when it held that the elements of the condemnation petition are not jurisdictional. If it
I understand everybody concedes that there is subject matter jurisdiction. There was some confusion in the county court at law, but as I read the briefs and I didn't quite get that from the Court of Appeals opinion, but what I get from the briefs is we're not really talking about subject matter jurisdiction.
That might be what the landowners are calling it now, Justice O'Neill, but the arguments are the same. The landowner's argument is that there is something special about the special commissioner's hearing. If the special commissioners don't consider it, then the landowner is damaged. The landowner is prejudiced. But the end game here is not the special commissioner's hearing. The end game is just an adequate compensation for the landowner.
But it strikes me that it's how much importance you put in the special commissioner's proceedings. Because if we follow your position all the way through, then that just becomes a pro forma. It doesn't really matter what you do before the special commissioners, because you can start all over or do whatever you want to when you get to the trial de novo.
That's really not right. Both parties have a good incentive to put everything that they know before the special commissioners. The parties, including the state and any condemning authority like a pipeline or a railway, are going to behave rationally. If they know what they're going to do, and in good faith, that's what they're going to build, and like Mr. Montague represents, if putting that plan on can help limit the damages to the state or to the condemning authority, then they will do that. And
so let me follow through then. What happens? Somebody, you've got a shopping center, and the state wants to take it and build a frontage road down it, and there's going to be plenty of access. That's fine. And so you have special commissioners. They give you the money. You're satisfied with the money for the land. You take it, and that's the end of it. And then the state, when they build the highway, decides they want a wall on the frontage road so that is they have you are absolutely cannot get to it because they build this big wall. Now, what do I do to get my money for diminished access now that the condemnation proceeding's all over?
You file an inverse condemnation claim against the state. And you
and I haven't waived anything.
No.
It's all taken. I can do all that later. They've changed the plans. And so, and do I go back through the special commissioners?
No. You file an inverse condemnation claim directly against the state. There's nothing about the change. There's nothing in the statute that requires the state to come to the special commissioners with the plan. And the fact that the state has changed the plan doesn't prejudice the landowner at all.
Well, doesn't that cause just more time and expense and waste of judicial resources, and then you put perhaps a landowner at a disadvantage from rightfully getting what he or she should have been entitled to in the first place had the plan been as revealed to them as it was ultimately going to be laid out?
Let me answer those questions not in exactly the order that you asked them, Justice Medina. If the landowner and the condemning authority agree with the price that the special commissioners put on it and the condemning authority deposits that money in the registry of the court and the landowner withdraws the money, the case is over. And then if the state changes the plan, we're in Justice Brister's hypothetical, and the landowner immediately has a lawsuit for inverse condemnation. But to answer really what's underlying your question, condemnors are going to behave rationally. They are not going to bait and switch because that will set up condemnors in the situation of potentially having to pay twice.
Well, that's what it looks like happened here, quite frankly, as I read these briefs, that you had some party rely on what the state was presenting to them and then for whatever reason decided not to participate in the final resolution of this matter.
Well, no. Specialty retailers didn't participate in the special commissioner's hearing. No landowner is required to participate in the special commissioner's hearing. And even though they don't participate, they can still file objections and have their day in court. Now, specialty retailers was there at the trial court and found out about the change a couple of days after PR Investments found out about the change. So the amount of time between the two landowner parties, the tenant and the landowner, is not substantial at all. The timing of the change, you're right, is not ideal. But, you know, we have to look at this whole thing in the spectrum. Prior to the...
Let me ask you, though, I'm not clear about your argument that the condemnor might have to pay twice. Why? It looks to me like in the inverse condemnation case, the condemnor would claim a credit for whatever they paid so far.
Well, I think that's possible, and I'm not, I don't, I...
Just possible? Wouldn't it always happen?
It would depend on what the damages were. Certainly, if the landowner...
You can't, surely the court's not going to make you pay twice for the sake of that.
What I'm saying is there are situations where if the landowners are right, that condemning authorities are going to lie behind the log and try to limit the damages they pay by putting on evidence of the least invasive plan possible to limit the damages now in the trial court, trick the landowner into taking that amount of money. The condemning authority is going to pay for that, all right?
But how much are they going to pay? More than they would have had to pay anyway? Because the landowner now is being put out. They've got to file two cases instead of, or they've got to participate in two cases instead of one.
Right, and the waste of time for judicial resources and as well as the condemning authority's resources militate against the condemning authority doing that in the first place.
Well, but if I were a nefarious condemning authority, not the state, of course, and I just wanted to run the other guy out, I'd say, well, how long can he keep it up? I mean, we're here forever, but at some point he's going to say, well, I give up.
Could the condemning authority continue to change the plan and continue to change the plan? Certainly the trial court has it within its discretion at some point. I mean, if we're going to spin your hypothetical out, Justice Heck, then a trial court could probably find that the condemning authority was behaving in an abusive manner, that the litigation tactics were abusive. That should result in the trial court saying, you can't change the plan anymore. You have to go to trial based on what you're going to do.
Let me ask you
what
you
said you're going to do.
If you came in early on, and this was totally in good faith, and no question about that, and you said, well, yes, you know, this is the evidence we put on before the commissioners, but we've been looking at this, and we need to change this. And pretty much everybody says, well, that's right. But that does rather significantly change the obvious value of what's being lost. At that point, does the county court have any interim authority to say, well, I'll let you change course here, but you got to put up another amount of money for the landowner to withdraw or something? Is there any interim authority to compensate the landowner for this interim taking before final judgment?
No. The only arguable window that the court could certainly leave open would be discovery sanctions, if the state was behaving in an abusive manner. But in your hypothetical, no, that's not the case. But remember, if the party has objected to the landowner's right to take, if the landowner has objected to the condemnor's right to take, the condemnor is not going to withdraw the money from the registry of the court because we're going to be contesting the value. And so the landowner's not getting compensated anyway. It's not like the landowner takes that money and runs off and it's now got some money that it can work with. The end game here is just compensation for the landowner. The state from the beginning of the process to the end of the process can change what the road is.
Counsel, let me, the Court of Appeals judgment, the conclusion is that the trial court erroneously dismissed the state's condemnation action and awarded excessive sanctions. So they said that they reversed it and remanded for further proceedings. Now, further proceedings including not limited to the trial court's consideration of what monetary sanctions should be assessed against the state in regard to the way this is conducted. Does the state have any objection to that ruling of the Court of Appeals?
Well, we haven't raised that as an issue before the court, of course, but we do disagree that just changing the road plan could ever be abusive behavior. The state has a duty.
Okay, but that would be for the trial court to,
yes.
Under this judgment, you go back and the trial court is going to look at it. Would one of those options in the state's view be that the trial court could abate the proceeding and remand for further proceedings before the commissioners?
The parties, I really think, agree that there's no way to go back to this particular special commissioners. The group has been disbanded. I suppose the trial court could assign the case to a new set of special commissioners. But then we're starting over again with a whole new process. Again, we're introducing more waste into the system that the court said in Hubenak was unnecessary, when the whole purpose of the trial de novo is to give the landowner the opportunity to demonstrate its damages.
But if we stay with this judgment of the Court of Appeals, then we leave it to the trial court to decide what to do instead of mandating the trial court just dismiss and we start all over. We leave it to the trial court's judgment.
The amount of money that the state must pay to PR Investments, if any, would be within the trial court's discretion. If the court stays with the Court of Appeals' opinion, the case goes back to the trial court for the condemnation trial. And at that point, PR Investments and specialty retailers will be able to put on their evidence of what they say the impact on their land is going to be, because of the state's change back to the original plan. And let me point out that it's not the case that the landowners have been confronted by the state with a completely new and different plan that they had never heard of. The state came to the proceedings with Plan A. I can't remember the names that the courts put on the cases. I go with Plan A and Plan B. It came to the proceedings with Plan A. It changed Plan B on PR Investments and specialty retailers' request. And then after it determined that in actuality that was not the best road, the safest and the most cost-effective road for the state to build, and those are perfectly legitimate reasons for the state to decide to change the road.
Can I ask you, what does 21.0195C mean when it says, quote, to fail to bring the proceeding properly?
I think that has to refer back to 21.012. If the condemning authority fails to bring a proceeding properly, it has to fail to file its petition properly. And we know from Hubenak that those elements are not jurisdictional. So, under Hubenak, if a condemning authority files its petition, it fails to comply with one of those elements, the trial court abates the proceedings, gives the condemning authority the opportunity to cure. If the condemning authority does not cure, then we know from Hubenak dismissal is proper. If that happens, 21...
Hubenak was a different matter. I mean, Hubenak didn't involve the facts that went to the amount of compensation. It was more of a procedural hurdle that didn't go through the special commissioners.
Well, the good faith offer, of course, would be something that is going to be before the special commissioners. I mean, the special commissioners are going to consider what both sides view.
It's an element, but it's not something that the commissioners use as a fact to base their compensation award on. It's a different element. Well, entirely.
I think the special commissioners would at least consider what the state considered to be the value of the property in coming to its determination of the value of the property. That is one of the elements that the special commissioners considered. And again, we have to remember that the special commissioners hearing is not recorded. It's not reviewed by the trial court. Justice O'Neill, you asked, what does the trial court do? Does it review for substantial evidence, factual sufficiency? Could it affirm the decision of the special commissioners? No, to all of that. The special commissioner's award isn't even admissible in the trial court.
Then what are, if any, from the state's position, the binding effects of the special commissioner's decisions on the trial de novo? What limitations are created?
There are no limitations. The parties are not limited in what evidence they put on before the... You can ask a question?
There's some case law, some language in some of our opinions that says there are some limitations, that the de novo trial is an appeal, and the language says that inherently creates some limitations.
Well, if you're referring to State v. Nelson, now, okay, I went a little past where I should have. Yes, the trial court cannot consider additional property. That was not the subject of the condemnation proceedings before the special commissioners. That is a real and substantial limitation on the trial court. Pardon me. The trial court cannot consider parties that had not been made a party to the proceeding by the filing of the petition and then going to the special commission. But beyond that...
Those are the only two.
What the court said in State v. Nelson, the trial court's jurisdiction is appellate as opposed to original or concurrent, does not bring with it and import into the eminent domain trial court's position everything we know about the relationship between trial courts and appellate courts. We've discussed why the special commissioners is not like a trial court. No record. You don't have to be there. No rules of procedure. There's no legal findings being made there. Let's talk about the trial court in an eminent domain proceeding. It doesn't review. I'm sorry. That's right. It doesn't review. It determines anew. It can have all of the evidence come in and value the property because that's the point.
And
the court couldn't.
Let me ask you, though. Do you think it's possible for a condemning authority to change course substantially during the proceeding to the prejudice of the landowner?
Change the road plan?
Change the highway plan, the construction plan, whatever there is. I mean, is it possible that in this, from your perspective, that in this process a change would be so substantial that there would be a prejudice to the landowner in the process?
Well, there wouldn't be, because the landowner will always be able to put on whatever evidence it needs to in the trial court to demonstrate the harm.
So your view is that it can't be. The landowner cannot be prejudiced in this situation.
The only way the landowner could have been prejudiced in this situation is if the trial court wouldn't have allowed a continuance and would have required the landowners to go to trial based on the state's late change in the plan without giving them the opportunity
But if the trial court granted continuances always cost money. Continuances usually are conditioned on paying the fees of whoever wasn't at fault. Could that? I don't see how under 21095 trial court could do that. Is there some way? Because wouldn't be dismissing it.
No, the trial court couldn't dismiss. I think the only way the trial court could award some fees for that, for the inconvenience of having to go back and redo things, would be under its inherent power for discovery abuse. But, again, there would have to be some...
And the state won't object to that if the trial court does that.
I guess I can't make that representation, Justice Brewster. We don't think changing the plan could ever be abusive, and in this case it wasn't abusive.
Well, obviously, I mean, that's the problem here. If you can't dismiss it, then the state can do this. And they have to pay Mr. Montague's not insubstantial fees to go through all this again. And y'all are going to say, that's just tough.
Well,
and that just doesn't seem quite fair, does it?
Well, you know, it's never fair for defendants to have to pay their attorney's fees because they've been sued by plaintiffs. But we as a society have decided that we're not going to compensate you for your attorney's fees unless you fall within the particular confines of a statute. In this case, that's 21.0195, and it requires dismissal.
But let me ask you, though, to take a hard case. If the condemning authority said we're going to build a highway, but allow access, and that's the plan, so the damages are really very small. And then in the county court, they change the plan and say, no, we're going to build it, but we're going to deny, or using the same property, but now we're going to deny access. So now the damages are potentially much greater. In your view, that there's no prejudice to the landowner in that change?
There's no prejudice that the legislature has decided to compensate, Justice Hackett.
But I'm just trying to get at whether there's a prejudice at all.
But you're also saying there's a remedy in that situation.
Yes, the landowner can file their inverse condemnation claim. But I take you to mean that there's costs involved in that.
Yes.
Absolutely. There are, you know, it used to be the case that the state could just take property and the landowner had to file suit in order to get compensation. Well, the legislature has put these property code provisions into place to create the structure. Now, I would like to go back to your question, Justice Wainwright, about the appellate jurisdiction nature of the trial court, because you think back, let's go back all the way to 1958, 2 years before Nelson, in Texas Power and Light versus Cole, the court acknowledged a situation where a condemnor amended its petition to reduce the scope of its acquisition in the trial court. The court approved that change. It said the condemning authority had the absolute right to do that. It acknowledged that.
But this isn't scope of the acquisition. This is a redesign of the plan that affects the amount awarded.
Yes, but the scope of the acquisition was different from what the special commissioners were considering, which is exactly what the landowners say in this case is the whole problem. And in fact, Cole is a tougher case, right? Because that was the petition. This case is not even the petition. It's not any place required in the property code for the state to come forward with that.
But would you
plan.
Agree that in the trial de novo, the rules that govern trials in general apply?
Yes.
And so why don't we treat it just like a trial amendment, that if somebody's going to try to amend their petition, then they have to pay the other side whatever prejudice that amendment causes? You don't dispute that could be the case.
I certainly think the court could leave that as an option open. Yes, I do. But that remedy forecloses this dismissal notion. It also exposes what it really is going on here. The landowners didn't want the continuance. They objected to the state asked for the continuance. The trial court was going to give the landowners a continuance. The landowners objected to it. They wanted this case dismissed so they could get their attorney's fees, because that's the only way they can get their attorney's fees in this case.
There's another layer on top of the statutes here, maybe not a layer supposedly consistent with what's going on with the litigation, which is the rules of procedure. The court had a docket control order which governed the parties. It said amend by a certain date. It said discovery had to be supplemented by a certain date. State did neither in a timely fashion. Why isn't the trial court then within its authority to say you can't go to trial on the old plan because you did not comply with an order of the court?
Well, of course, the court would have been authorized to allow the amendment for good cause or to allow the supplementation for good cause. We would argue that the state's engineers who are over here working on the roads trying to come up with the best road, not coming up with the road that they want to go forward with until the unfortunate time as past the discovery cutoff, would be good cause. But I would agree with you that there could be circumstances where a trial court could say it would be, I would say, very unwise and wasteful of judicial resources to require the state to go to trial on a plan that it does not intend to build, that everyone knows it's going to change and build a whole another plan, and then setting up the inverse condemnation claim and a whole another lawsuit and the state's potentially having to pay for using two plans, right? It's going to be damages on A.
Petitioners would frame the question, I'm sure, differently, that the trial court was not necessarily requiring the state to go to trial on a plan it did not intend to build, but the trial court was going to preclude the state from going to trial on a plan that it didn't disclose it was going back to in a timely fashion. Those are two different things.
Yes, but how would a trial the trial couldn't
proceed? Because the state knew in a timely fashion that it was not planning to build the Sparks plan. It was going back to the Quarter plan.
No, that is not the case at all. The Assistant Attorney General
According to the briefs, before the November and December deadlines, the state was aware of its decision and which plan it was going to proceed on, soon enough to have disclosed that within the deadline set in the docket control order.
Well, my understanding was the state was making the decision during that time. It was reviewing the documents, but that the final decision was not made until after the discovery cutoff. The background rule here is the state, as the owner of the road and of the charge with the responsibility of protecting the driving public, has to have the flexibility to change the roads.
Mm-hmm. What if, let me assume that the state was aware of its decision to go back to the original plan before the discovery deadline. Would your answer change?
If the landowners could show that there was some abusive conduct on the part of the state in not disclosing that.
No, I'm limiting my question to compliance or noncompliance with the court's order, the docket control order. Assume the state knew or had the facts to have determined prior to the discovery deadline, supplementation deadline, that it was going to go back to the first plan but didn't disclose it before the deadline, would your answer change?
I'm going to have to say no, Justice Wainwright. There has to be the ability for the state to change the road plans. And there has to
be. So the state does not have to comply with the trial court's order?
Absolutely not. But your hypothetical.
What are you saying?
If your hypothetical is including that the state is intentionally not telling the landowner that it's going to change the plans for abusive reasons, then the trial court has authority to control that.
I'm not ascribing a motive. It may have been negligence. I don't know. But
then there's no abusive discovery conduct, and there's no reason to prevent the state from and all the parties from going to trial, having one trial on what's really going to happen, when the remedy would be a continuance, so the landowner can get its stuff together and go to trial on the right.
Are there any further questions? Thank you.
The court, Mr. Alan Hoagland will present the rebuttal for petitioners.
Hey, please, the court. I'm here for specialty retailers. My name is Alan Hoagland. To address one of the issues concerning the state announced ready at the trial of this case and sought to go to trial on the new plan, the quarter plan, that would materially prejudice specialty retailers and PRI. It was only after the trial court refused to allow them to go forward with that plan that they then moved for a continuance after we'd been down there for a couple of days. The situation here was...
Why does an inverse condemnation cure all this?
Well, the problem with the inverse condemnation is the Perot rule. As I understand the Perot rule, in the event that there was an opportunity to claim what your damages were in the eminent domain case, you are then precluded in a subsequent case to have the opportunity to make those claims. And so here, when you materially change and prejudice the landowner, and in particular like specialty retailers, when you had made promises back in 1998, in February of 98, before there ever was a special commissioner's hearing, specialty retailers felt like they were satisfied, they had reasonably safe access to their office complex, and that they were, in effect, didn't need to proceed in the lawsuit anymore.
But the question is, isn't a 2-3-whatever-month continuance, and let's fight it all out now, more efficient than closing this down, pay several $100,000 in attorney's fees or whatever it is, start over at the special commissioners, and over a 2-year process, do it all over again?
Absolutely not. What should be done is what the trial court did here. It did not have appellate jurisdiction. It did not have the power to proceed because of the material change. The case should have been dismissed, as it was, with prejudice. And then the state, if they wanted to change their plan, would then have afforded, instead of making representations to specialty retailers, which they had agreed to not to pursue, they could start with a new condemnation action, and within 30 days they could have possession.
So your answer is, yes, we need to do it the much more expensive and inefficient way because that's the way the statute requires it to be done.
Well,
no question that would be more inefficient to start all over and do it at 2 years again.
I don't think it would be because in this instance what's happened is by the bait and switch that we argue from the state's perspective, the specialty retailers didn't even go to the special commissioner's hearing that's mandated by the legislature and didn't have an opportunity then to deal with the issue that we're dealing with here now, which is a material change.
What difference does that make? If the special, I think what I'm hearing, and condemnation's not my area, but I think what I'm hearing is the special commissioner's proceeding is really intended to see if the landowners will accept what the special commissioner's award, and you don't have to go any further, and that's the amount that's the purpose of the special commissioner's proceeding. Their decision is not admissible in the trial de novo. There'd be nothing to prevent the trial court from hearing evidence on the Sparks plan and awarding a higher amount based on the Sparks plan. So if that's the case, what appellate jurisdiction are we talking about other than just the original description of the property?
Because as I understand the legislature's mandate, the whole purpose of this is one for a quick take so the state or the governmental authority can get possession of the property in a short period of time, but then to comply with Article 1, Section 17 of the Texas Constitution to be sure that there's just compensation that is paid into the registry of the court through the special commissioner's hearing based upon what the state in this instance limited their use to and limited their intended use to. And so from the perspective of what has happened is, in this instance, specialty retailers never was afforded that opportunity. as it relates to the special commissioner's hearing that is mandated, and that's what should be done, not a continuance where they're then deprived of that opportunity. Like in this instance, they would have not incurred one nickel in attorney's fees or expenses in this case had the state not materially changed their plan. And in this instance now, because we're here before this court some 9 years later, they've incurred $100,000 in costs that they never would have incurred but for the state's decision that we're going to...
Hold on one second.
I'm sorry, Justice O'Neill.
Did the tenant seek to have that proceeding done? Did the tenant request that we go back and have special commissioners appointed so I can go through that process now on this different plan?
Yes. What we did was we moved for a dismissal without prejudice, so that they could start over again and go through the proper proceeding for bringing this action, as opposed to what they tried to do with the bait and switch, substantially materially affecting the landowners.
So they asked to start over, but they didn't specifically request, Judge, send us down to the commissioners for the Sparks plan.
Well, the commissioners, they'd already heard the Sparks plan, the special
plan. I mean the quarter plan.
The quarter plan. The commissioners have been disbanded. There's no way to go back to the commissioners. That's why the procedure is that you have a dismissal under 210195 as it relates to when you do not properly bring the proceeding, and then you start over again and go through the process that the legislature has set up and that the Article 1, Section 17 of the Texas Constitution requires. And in this instance, it's just a complete travesty and unfair to what has happened to specialty retailers and PRI simply because the state decided, well, we've done away with specialty retailers because they agreed to what we want to do, and now let's concentrate on PRI and our litigation tactic, because that's what the record reflects, is this was purely a litigation tactic by the state in an effort to lower the damages which they otherwise would have to pay to PRI. And what happened here is the young attorney general didn't see the forest for the trees, because what in effect happened by changing the plan brought in millions of dollars worth of damage because of the unreasonably safe access specialty retailer is going to move, if that's the case, because they cannot put their employees into this kind of danger.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Your time has expired, and the clause is submitted. The court will take a brief recess.
All rise.